Letting everyone get settled. So, good evening, everyone. I kind of miss the chant that traditionally in my teacher's sangha and in other sanghas, we chant before the Dharma talks, which we just never reproduced because it's all been very organic and chanting was difficult when no one knew the chants except me. And so we have integrated some of them, but not all of them. And this is one that I kind of miss, actually. And I'm wondering, did we chant it when I was speaking to Frank Roshi's Sangha?
Yes.
We did, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, he did, anyway, yeah. And it's a really nice chant, and I was thinking about it as I was sitting. It's called the Gatha on Opening the Sutra. And Zen is supposedly something that is outside of the sutras. A teaching that is outside of the sutras. So at the same time, we're chanting this. And the chant is, the Dharma is incomparably profound and infinitely subtle. It's rarely encountered, even in millions of ages. Now we see it, hear it, receive and maintain it. May we completely realize the Tathagata's true meaning. Joa's cat was captivated by that verse. She didn't move. Now she's turning away. So it doesn't say the Dharma is rare. It says it's rare for us to encounter it because the Dharma is just every moment as it is. So it's not saying it's some, rare, precious thing, rare, precious because it's rare. It's that we rarely see it because we're occupied with other things. Like John Lennon said, life is what happens while we're planning for other things. So it doesn't say that the Dharma is rare. And then we have this notion of the true meaning. So what is the true meaning? May we completely realize the true meaning. And the true meaning also is very simple. It's just to be intimate with the truth of things as they are. To be intimate with your life as it is, whatever is presented to you. Whatever your predicament is, whatever your situation is. So to be intimate with that. So what does it mean to be intimate with? Okay, that's a whole nother subject, right? It involves not knowing, not having an idea. But when I was thinking about this, I thought, because we don't chant it, you're not familiar with it, but I've chanted it many, 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 many times. And I don't think that for a long time, I thought of it as the Dharma being rare. Because we say it's profound and subtle. So for some reason, I was thinking that they were saying the Dharma is rare, but it doesn't. It says that it's rare to encounter it. And then I probably for a long time thought this, you know, maybe we, can we really receive the Tathagata's true meaning? And so it was this some inconceivable thing that I couldn't possibly realize. And then I think, you know, as my practice has matured and as I've said that over and over again and practiced it, not only said it, but practiced it, I've come to understand that it means that the true meaning is just this, things as they are. But that's also conceptual, right? Just this. So I was thinking about this, I think probably while sitting, because the other day I was sitting at the breakfast table, looking out at my garden, talking with my husband. And, you know, it's just this endless litany of things that, the endless woes of the world, you know, whether it's the pandemic, whether it's economic, environmental, social disasters. You know, the government is not doing this, the government is doing that wrong. This vaccine is not good. Just like endless stuff, you know. And so if you're sitting there at breakfast with the newspaper, which is what I do, that's, although I start at the back of the newspaper. For years, probably for 40 years, I've started at the back of the newspaper. I read backwards. And I find that my life is much richer because of it. Because what they call in the newspaper business, the back of the book, that means the back of the newspaper, is the things, you know, it's like culture, literature, social things, commentary. The cartoonist usually has his drawing or her drawing at the back of the book. Things that they feel like, well, it's not the most important. We should put the most important stuff at the front of the book. Well, I start at the back because I think that stuff is more important for me in my life. Even so, as I turn the pages, I will come to all the rest of it. And even now in the culture pages, we have all the rest of it too. The economic problems with the culture industries, the museums are closed, the cinemas are closed, the theaters are closed. Endless. So we're sitting there talking about all of this, and I'm looking out at the garden, and suddenly I remember that last year at this time, I was spending most of my days lying in my room looking out at the garden, but from the floor above. My room is upstairs overlooking the garden, and the breakfast is, the dining room is on the ground floor. And so I was looking at the same garden, and I remembered, I have not forgotten, but I guess just this situation brought it back, what a powerful experience it was to be that sick, as I've told you already, but to be, you know, I would say that I was experiencing the Tathagata's true meaning in those moments. And I was appreciating, because there were moments when I didn't know if I would see another spring. I didn't know. And, it was a dark time last spring, right? Nobody really knew so much about this. We still don't know a lot about the COVID, but we knew even less then. And I didn't know if I was going to make it and to see another spring. And I came to have this deep appreciation for things as they are. And just to be alive was enough, which was a life-changing experience. It was as if I was encountering the Dharma, you know, things as they are, and realizing the impermanence of it because of my situation, realizing really time swiftly passes by and opportunity is passes quickly. So what do I want to do with this time? I may not see another spring. So what do I want to do now? How do I want to live this moment right now? So a few days ago, sitting at my kitchen table, I had that same kind of awakening of, oh yeah, okay, there's all this stuff. There's all this trouble in the world. And yet, look at that, the garden, the birds, you know, these birds are coming along and we watch them. They come and they're taking little twigs and they're going to build their nests. And there's kind of territorial things going on between the turtle doves, the magpies, the blackbirds, the little sparrows. The cats are coming and going because our garden is kind of a passageway for the neighborhood cats. It snowed on Tuesday afternoon, completely out of nowhere. I mean, it's the weirdest thing. Surreal. Really having a deep appreciation for it. Coming from this recognition of the impermanence of it, that it's not always going to be here. I'm not always going to be here. That this is the nature of my being. And I happen to have made, I'm making these pages in my notebook. I showed one of them at Frank's, when I talked in Frank's Sangha. Actually two of them, you saw two of them. And I had this other one that, I don't know, I'll hold it up. I don't know if you can see it. So this one is, how is it to be in the midst of delight, is what the big cutout words say, right? And then all around is written what are called the five remembrances, which I will read them to you. There's different translations that come from the sutra that Joa probably knows, but I don't know it. So the first one, I am of the nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. So that's one. Two, I am of the nature to have ill health. There is no way to escape having ill health. Three, I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape death. Four, all that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. Five, my actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground upon which I stand. So these are called the five remembrances. The first three we recognize because this is what led the Buddha off on his quest. Old age, sickness, and death. And the other two are, the fourth one is about non-attachment. You know, everything is changing, impermanent. And the fifth one is leading us to, you know, what we call the Eightfold Path, responsibility, right? So responsibility for our life, for our speech, our action, and our thought. The karmic consequences of what we think, say, and do. This notion of responsibility is interesting because if I truly realize that I am responsible for how I live my life, that's a big thing. It's like, oh, okay, I'm responsible. So what am I going to do then? What am I going to do with my life? What am I going to do with this precious little time I have? Because there isn't a lot of time, you know? Time swiftly passes by. So my responsibility is what to do, what actions. I recently exchanged with someone whose mother, my own mother-in-law, my husband's mother, has been recently put into a nursing home. And someone else in the Sangha's mother has recently been put in a nursing home too. And so we were exchanging about that. And I said that this, I told him that this in encountering the old age, the sickness and the death, especially when it's our parents or someone close to us, gives rise to great humility and kindness and love and compassion. Because, you know, there's no one who is an exception to it. None of us, as these five remembrances say, none of us can escape that. That's where we're all going, where our parents are now. If our parents are still alive, some of us, some people's parents, my father's no longer alive, my mother, yes, but. So if we can really recognize it, see it, I see this for myself, that when I was so sick and recognizing my vulnerability, that I too, I'm no exception. I too can be sick. I too can face death. I too am growing old. Mm-hmm. Great humility. And there's something really beautiful and joyous in that humility. So this other phrase comes from a koan, which I can't remember what koan it is, of how is it to be in the midst of delight? And I put those words in the middle of these five remembrances. You can say, well, why is that a delight, those five remembrances? Those sound like the worst things I would ever want to know. But actually, if we can see life as it is, truly, We see these five remembrances, and these things remind us of it. There's an accompanying thing that goes with it, and I can't remember what it is, but something like the five gifts, something like that, where meeting an old person, it is a gift because it reminds us of the nature of our own being. Meeting a sick person, meeting an old person, it's an occasion to wake up, to recognize the suffering, to wake up to the reality, the true meaning, about it, the Buddha's true meaning. And when we fully realize that, there's this immense joy and delight in the birds picking up twigs to build nests, or in, you know, eating an apple. In being, just being alive. It's a delight to be alive. It doesn't mean that there's, you know, this is like, you know, happy fairy tale life. Doesn't mean that. It means appreciating your life as it is. It means Time swiftly passes by. So how do we live this life, which is short and constantly changing? What do we do, you know? Somebody, I can't remember if it was somebody here, like maybe Tiago or João or someone, told me about reading Oscar Wilde's letters from prison or something. Was it Tiago who told me about it? Yeah. Yeah. And there's this quote in that where he says, I wrote it down because I really liked it. The most terrible feature of life in prison is not that it breaks one's heart. Hearts are made to be broken. But that it turns one's heart to stone. So don't let your heart turn to stone. You know, it's hearts break. Like we say, the only whole heart is a broken heart. And I know from my own experience, before, you know, years, like in another lifetime, before my second life began, when I realized I only had one, how I tried to shut things out. You know, I didn't want to say goodbye to people because I didn't want to feel the pain, so I just left without saying goodbye. Or I didn't want to see someone who was hurt or dying, so I just didn't go visit them. I didn't want to acknowledge someone had died, and so I didn't say anything to the person who had lost someone. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not a lot, not completely. My heart was, you know, I kind of was letting my heart turn to stone. I wasn't really, but I was covering it so that I wouldn't feel. And I realize, you know, now, once I woke up from that life, how much we miss when we do that. How much we let ourselves be cold and almost dead, even though we're alive. And so that's what happens when we fully acknowledge these five remembrances, and that's where the delight is. I've sometimes told this story, maybe not here, I don't know, of, this is hard for all of you Portuguese to hear, or even for most Europeans, but in the United States, if you grow up in the middle of the country, it's possible to never see the ocean. And I remember the first time I saw the ocean. I think I was 14. And I was with friends. I was visiting friends who lived on the East Coast. And it was night. And we thought we were being very adventurous. And we would go out to the, you know, to the coast, to the beach at night. And I wasn't really thinking about it. But we came up over these dunes. Already you could hear it. Right? You can hear the ocean at night like that. And it was dark. We came up over these dunes and it was the most utterly, I don't even know how to describe what I experienced. Total emptiness. And I was so moved and so shaken by it. But because I was 14 and I was with my friends and I wanted to be cool and I wanted to be, you know, not show any emotions or something, I acted like it was nothing special. Sometimes it even makes me cry to think of that, what I did to myself at that moment, by trying to pretend like it was nothing special. I never forgot it though. So it was always there. And when I was able to appreciate it, it came back. And I could recognize it. And it served me as a wonderful example of what we do when we don't want to feel, when we don't want to express, when we don't want, because that's a powerful thing. I know it's really hard for you in Portugal to understand this, but the ocean is a powerful thing to see for the first time. It's so unlike anything else. there's no horizon. There's no firm ground. It's just unbelievably vast. I think it was probably one of my first, I had experiences of emptiness before, but in that sense, it was a real experience of emptiness. And it was terrifying as well. I think that's also why I tried to hide it. And that's what, when we think of life being impermanent, that also is what we feel. It's this kind of breathless, I can't do that. I can't acknowledge that. Everything's changing. Everything will be lost. I can't go there. And so we let our hearts turn to stone instead of fully embracing it. And so the delight is, I ask this question, how is it to be in the midst of this with delight? The delight comes when we live in harmony with it, when we live in harmony with this basic truth of things as they are, when we don't try to change them, we don't expect them to be different, we don't expect ourselves to be different, we don't expect the others, someone else to be different. We can be intimate with the truth of our lives, whether it's being, really sick in bed, or, being wrapped up in your work, struggling to have your children at home because the schools are closed, having to take care of your old parents, wondering where you're going to get the money to pay for the rent, whatever it is. Be intimate with that. That's what being in harmony with it means, being one with it. So oh yeah, I remember what it is. So they're not gifts. It's five divine messengers. That's what it is. So these messengers that remind us of, I don't remember exactly what they are, but it's definitely a sick person, an old person, a dying person, and I don't know what the other two are. But, it basically, so when we say to, realize the true meaning, the truth about life, it means don't lie to yourself about the nature of life. Sometimes we say, don't kid yourself in English. It means, don't lie to yourself. It's really, the temptation is great to lie to ourselves. I will not die, right? Someone, I forget who it was, someone, Gandhi maybe, or someone said, the amazing thing is that of how many X number of Indians, I don't know how many Indians there were in the population at that time. The amazing thing is that everyone in that population knows that everyone else in that population is going to die. But they all also cannot accept that they will die. That's the amazing thing. Everyone thinks that they will be the exception. Everyone else will die. We know that. But not me. In fact, there are no exceptions. So that's what we say by I don't mean lie, like intentionally lying, but it means wake up to the truth of it. Look around, see the impermanence. Appreciate it, what it is now, because it's my yellow tulips back there are fading by the day. I'm fading by the day. I had this really strange experience yesterday where I went to take a photo for my passport. I have to get my passport renewed, my American passport. And so I went and did it. And then I came home and I have to send in my old passport. This is almost kind of embarrassing, but in the two photos, I'm wearing the same clothes. The exact same thing. 10 years apart, the same clothing. I couldn't believe it. I mean, what are the chances of me wearing the same thing 10 years apart? My husband said, well, I guess that proves you don't buy clothes very often. I mean, there is something to that, but very weird. So, you know, in French we say, I have become more wrinkled, but the clothes haven't in those 10 years. But so time swiftly passes by, you know. I hate to think what I will look like 10 years. You know, I don't want to know what I will look like 10 years from now when I get my next passport. But that was also, a divine messenger to see the difference between the pictures, although the clothing is the same. So that's kind of an interesting thing too, you know. There is something that is, the one thing we can count on is impermanence. So it's like my clothes were reminding me of impermanence, which seems like a paradox. And you know, a baby is a divine messenger, actually, because a baby reminds us of this, wow, this new life, this fabulous, beautiful, a kitten, you know, this fabulous, beautiful new life, potential, these birds out there building their nests, springtime. And yet, and we unconditionally, the baby is like a unconditional beauty, love we feel for babies, kittens, puppies, you know, things like that. And yet we know that in a few months, the baby's going to be waking us up at night and the kitten will do something naughty. And then the child will grow older and it's not so perfect anymore. I mean, it is perfect, but we get angry at the child. And the baby is a reminder of that impermanence as well. Because that baby is going to change. We want the baby to change. We want the baby to grow up. We love watching babies grow up. We love marking when they walk, when they start talking, their first word, when they can eat solid food, when they're toilet trained. You know, we want babies to evolve. And that this is pure impermanence. So why are there some versions of impermanence that we like and others that we don't? A baby is a divine messenger. It's birth, but it's also death. We know where that baby's going. You know, it's going the same place we're going. So that's the the Tathagata's true meaning. Just to be alive is enough. Really. Anyone, questions or comments or sharing of anything? João?
There's a sentence that's been with me for some days now, just came to me, and it's so interesting because it's so much in tune with what you said. I tried to find it because I'm not sure, and it really doesn't matter. I think it has to do with some description of Napoleon. It has to do with Napoleon, his kind of the wars that he fought. Anyway, the sentence is something like, from victory to victory until the final defeat. That's because I guess he won a lot of battles, and then he finally lost the final one. And the way that sounds to me is the final defeat is a way of saying death. That's inescapable.
Yeah.
And to me, from victory to victory is very interesting because it's like saying each moment. Because that's the, and I was thinking of this in terms of, that's the only actual victory, that is each moment fully. That's because the final defeat is inescapable. It's death. Death in nothing being permanent. And so the only possible victory for each of us is each moment can be a victory in that sense. So this has been accompanying me for the last days.
And we could even think of the I understand what the implication of the final defeat, that death finally wins, right? But we could see that as we can have victory in that moment as well.
Mm-hmm.
It could be, you know, maybe temporary victory to temporary victory until the final victory or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean that in the sense of, if we are in harmony with, you know, if we are in harmony with death, if we can live in harmony with death, with the truth of the final defeat, then it's a victory. Too.
Yeah, because death is not actually a defeat if I really accept it,
yeah.
I mean, really accept it,
yeah.
That's not a defeat.
Right.
Well, I don't know. We're just using these words, you know. But
right.
Yeah. Thank you.
Isn't it also actually considered a liberation for the awakened one when you're dead, when there's no rebirth? Isn't that in some Buddhist traditions?
Well,
you're free.
Yeah, I mean, then we enter into this territory of reincarnation and arhats and Buddhas and all of that, which is not at all my experience or tradition. The liberation is to be, to awaken to things as they are. That's the That's it. And we could say that in some ways that's a death, because we are letting go of, we are dying to, you know, it's like the second life begins when we see we only have one. So we're dying to that old self who was attached to permanence, denying old age, sickness, and death, things like that. Christine?
Yeah, thank you for this talk. It reminds me also a lot of this story where the man is chased by tigers or something and falling off a cliff, and in the last moment can attraps a some wood and from a tree and see some strawberries. I think you even told that story, yeah? And then, so there is no other, he will die either by the tigers getting him or falling off the cliff and being dead. And he sees strawberries and he eats these strawberries and says, what a delight. That story that came up for me, and I can relate a lot to this experience of being close to death and then experiencing the delight in it. So I had something like that after my sister's death, when the first wave of grief was over. I experienced quite a deep joy, you know, of still being alive after all that. And also looking at the people around me and thinking, why does everybody care so much about whatever stuff, you know? That seemed quite incredible at that time. And so it's certainly this has had a big influence on my life, about how I want to live my life, of knowing it can change any moment, so I also liked a lot these five messengers, or especially the last one, of the only thing is your actions, the only thing you leave, or you can. Yeah, that's really powerful.
Yeah.
And with the story of the ocean, of not expressing what you felt, or wanting to be cool. That's so much how I was too when I was young. Maybe you can relate to the other someone. Yes. I was not long ago in a school teaching or talking, giving some talk about how to deal with feelings, and when I said that when I was young, I wanted to turn my heart to a stone, one of the adults who was in the room told me that at least one girl was nodding her head. And I think that a lot of the problems we have result from not being true to our feelings and not expressing the feelings. So that's one of my some of the actions that I want to do here in this world, to help young or to help others realize that feelings are true and they are important, and that we can live all of our feelings. We don't have to shut off. Roshi told this once in a talk about, she was in some psychiatric clinic or something where she did a meditation on metta or something, and she told people to inhale the dark and exhale the light. And she said that a lot, or at least one, I don't know if it was several people, but that she realized the body posture change from people that they were dressing up, and by doing this meditation of, yes, we can also live painful things and still see the light or be the light. And
right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Delight.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, the thing about looking around after, when you said after your sister's death, and looking around and wondering, how amazed at how people could be so preoccupied mm-hmm. with certain things, and there's a great poignancy in that. For I know my experience has been that when that happens. And it's not a judgmental kind of attitude. It's like almost my heart bursts with love for everyone, because I know what it is to be preoccupied with how I look, what I have, what I don't have, being the best, getting ahead, anything, you know, even from like, you know, I have to get my nails done or something. And big and little, you know, little and big things. And there's something so deeply moving about that, I find, about the humanness of that and the poignancy. It's like a bittersweet kind of thing, because we see how vanité, you know, how futile it is, and how missing the point it is. And yet at the same time, we fully know what it is about. We've been there. We are there. And so there's something really, that was my experience last spring, of love came from that. Of just this vast love. And seeing all of that stuff that people were all trying to do all the time. It's just efforts to give and receive love. Be loved. And we don't see that we are love.
It's a formless field of love, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. We didn't change it, but we could. We can. Absolutely. All things are impermanent. They arise and pass away. That's the Dharma. And the Tathagata's true meaning is to live in harmony with that. And then delight in this one life you have. Sue?
I don't know how to relate that with the talk, but by this image, when you see the ocean, I remembered the two or three days after my mother died, I was in a place very high in an apartment in Lisbon. And I look the whole city and I have a feeling like the ocean. I saw and I have the feeling everything is other thing. After she died, the world is changed completely for me. It was it was also good for me to feel that. It was like a whoosh, wake up. It's she was always there, and it was a reveal. It's like to see the ocean for me at this moment.
Thank you. Yeah. That's it. Absolutely. And you know, when you say she was always there, from the Zen point of view, we would say she still is, but she just doesn't answer.
Yeah. Or
in the way that you want her to.
Yeah. She's always there. She's always there. Yeah. I feel that. But this image, it was so. Yeah. It was something different in my mind.
Absolutely. And that's seeing the true meaning. Yeah, that's it.
Thank you.
I think we're out of time here. Time swiftly passes by. But we took advantage of the opportunity. We didn't miss it. Well, thank you. We'll do the vows.